Well, good evening, everyone. Great to be here tonight, and a particular welcome to our guest of honour, the inspirational Dr. Sue Boyd, who'll be talking soon. I'm John Goodlad. I'm the President of the Australian Institute of International Affairs for Western Australia, and I'm your MC tonight. I'm delighted to welcome you all here tonight. It's for a very special event. It's sort of a traditional AAIA meeting with a difference because we've got UWA Press here, happen to have the Governor here, we happen to have all sorts of people here. But it's for the launch of Sue's book, Not Always Diplomatic. And I'd like to pay a particular acknowledgement, special welcome to the Governor, His Excellency the Honourable Kim Beazley AC, the Vice-Chancellor, Professor Amit Chakra, and his wife, Deputy Vice-Chancellor Tayeb Shah, Kate Pickard from UWA Press, a number of fellows of the Institute, including my Vice-President, Professor Samina Yasmin, who's sitting at the front, a number of life members of the Institute who are here tonight, a number of donors to the Institute, my fabulous committee who wandered in with the Governor, and the members of the Institute. And you'll note that it's a members-only event tonight, so really pleased to see you all here tonight. But it's members and invited guests. So what do we all share in common? We're all friends from far and wide for Dr. Sue Boyd, and that's really why we're here tonight. And there are a number of friends who can't be here because we live in strange and challenging times who would be here from interstate overseas. So I'd like us to represent them and think of those people who'd be here tonight. I'm sure Sue will mention a number of them in her speech. So, friends all, welcome. I'd also like, on your behalf, to acknowledge and pay our respects to the traditional owners of the traditional custodians of the land, the Noongar Whadjuk people, and that's where we meet, particularly here close to the river. And I'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. And I'm fond of saying that we have six seasons in Perth, and we're all aware of that. And we're moving from Jilba, the season of the rains and the swooping magpies, to Kumburung, the warm change, and I think we can feel it today. And lots of young birds, so they don't have to swoop as much. They'll be warbling, and lots of flowers, in particular sprays of yellow that you'll see going forward, including the Christmas trees that come out here in Perth. So the format for tonight is fairly straightforward. I'll be introducing the Governor. I'll then introduce Kate Pickard from UWA Press. Then we'll have Dr. Sue Boyd, who'll be sitting there, and she's kindly agreed to do some Q&A, some questions and answers. Then Professor Mark Beeson will do a vote of thanks. There'll be plenty of time for book signing outside afterwards, and dinner at UWA Club's full. So it's a full house both here and there in these COVID times. So it's now my pleasure to introduce the Governor to the podium. He's a former President of the Australian Institute of International Affairs. He's a Fellow of the Institute of International Affairs. He's the official visitor to the Australian Institute of International Affairs for Western Australia. He's a former Minister, Cabinet Minister, Deputy Prime Minister, Ambassador, and he's Governor of our state. So I give it the Honourable Kim Beazley AC, Governor of Western Australia.
Well, thank you very much, John, for that introduction. And can I, as you did, first acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. Can I acknowledge to the Vice-Chancellor, Vice-Chancellor's wife, Sue, who's always a delight to see. And there are so many distinguished people here, I'm going to end it there and not attempt to read off the list and therefore deeply offend large numbers of people who wouldn't be included on it. So it's just those who I'm going to acknowledge. But I also want to say what an enormous privilege it is for me to be able to launch Sue's book, and I'm very grateful that she extended that privilege to me, and it's a labour that is of pure delight. I am going to just read the first paragraph of my introduction and then launch into the rest of the the rest of my remarks, because I do think it sums up the book, from my point of view, particularly well. And that is my opening paragraph in the introduction, which you all read after you've bought a copy. Not always diplomatic, but effective whether or not might be added to the long title for the book, but Sue would be too modest to do it. This is a story of her experiences, perspectives, thoughts, feelings, grievances, judgments, ideals, hopes, and fashion sense. However, as befits a lifetime spent in the service of our Foreign Affairs Department, it is a story of astute study of the desires, characters, fears, affections, hopes, objectives of others, many of whom, at either a modest or a substantial level, were capable of impacting on directions that were important to the Australian national interest. Sue is very funny, but she is never frivolous. This is a book which is both a joy to read and one from which much can be learned. I've known Sue for a very long time, and some of the facets of that knowledge are incorporated within the book itself. Not least of interest here in Western Australia is that in my time, I've lost a number of elections, but only one in the public domain. That was the election for President of the Guild of Undergraduates here at the University of Western Australia. Sue not only won the election and became the President of the Guild, but she was also the first woman to hold the post. Serving as her Vice President, I can attest that she excelled in the role. She pioneered as the first woman as President of the UWA Guild of Undergraduates. She was also a pioneer in our Foreign Affairs Department. And together with her few female colleagues within the department, she became a change maker for her gender and within that critical institution. I don't actually recognise the Foreign Affairs Department that she describes when it comes to issues related to gender, because by the time I was a member of that department, and I was a member of that department for 6 years, there was, as far as I could see, no discrimination against women. In fact, women were honoured, highly proficient, very actively engaged. I think, for example, of Frances Adamson, now the head of the department. When I was ambassador of the US, she was ambassador of China, and I would read her cables avidly every weekend to keep my knowledge as high as it could be, because one of the things the Americans most wanted me to discuss with them was what we thought about China. I remember Gillian Bird. She was ambassador to the United Nations, just ambassador before I left, but I served together with her for a year. And then I remember Jan Adams, who's just come back from being ambassador to China. Then she was sort of the equivalent of the head of the old Department of Trade. So I had a lot to do with Jan as we, not we, myself, but as I was involved in influencing the Americans in our discussions on the TPP, which is a major issue of the time. So women in the Foreign Affairs Department in senior positions played a big role in my life as ambassador. I realised that, having read the book, the reason why they were there is in no small measure due to what Sue did when she was one of a very small number of women who came into the Foreign Affairs Department with her. This is a book that can be looked at, I think, at two levels. One level is that of a personal journey, a story of her time, the times of her life, and they're in all ways a ripping yarn from beginning to end. If you look at choose to look at it that way, she details the extraordinary background she brought to Australia. She came here effectively as an international citizen. The family in which she lived, her father, had been a military official in the late phases of the empire and the continuation of a burgeoning Cold War. It put Sue in a position where she was living in a number of cultures, learning the languages associated with them, coming to university as a student, vastly more mature than any of the other students I had anything to do with at the time that I was at the university. And that goes on from those origins to discuss her early engagements in the department, her involvement over the years in a series of issues, including at the time of the Indonesian takeover in East Timor, running through, if you're looking at Cold War components of it, senior diplomat in the GDR, and how she conducted herself there, as I'm going to say a bit later, was a case study, moving through UN engagements, whole variety of diplomatic posts, which she'll no doubt outline, so I won't go through them. But all the time, there's a sort of underlying sub-theme of getting respect for her gender as a legitimate and strong participant in the affairs of the Department of Foreign Affairs. She also had a series of engagements in circumstances of difficulty or potential difficulty. She was our ambassador during the Spate coup in Fiji, also our ambassador at the beginnings of the Pacific Solution of John Howard in relation to refugees. In the first of those positions, her life was in danger, and she was said of a time there, every day she'd wake up and say, "Who am I to influence today?" Actually, I think when you read it, she woke up every day saying, "Who am I going to influence today?" That was a reflection of her pure professionalism. So the book is worthwhile reading from the many stories, many very funny, many self-deprecating, but as I said, never frivolous. That's one level on which you can view what Sue has to say in the book. The second level is altogether different. This is the fact that what she has produced is a compendium that would be critical for any would-be foreign affairs officer to read. We're in extraordinarily difficult circumstances now. There are two things which I think are being underdone in our national affairs these days. One is universities, but that's not for this particular gathering. The other is the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. We're in a situation of enormous confusion, great danger, and the collapse of principles which we have always thought were fundamental to our national survival in the international political system. And as we look at how we support ourselves, defend ourselves, ensure that we have a relationship, a set of relationships through the region, which are vital to our ability to pursue our issues of survival, read the book. As an ambassador, I understood very quickly that more than 90% of what I dealt with never made it into the media in any shape or form. And that would be so with everything that Sue had to handle herself. People keep saying things like, well, you don't actually need a Foreign Affairs and Trade Department, All you need to do is read a selection of decent newspapers, listen to some good podcasts, get yourself on social media and other people's social media. You'll know everything you need to know. Baloney. You know almost nothing. And what is happening while you're reading that is that in the Foreign Affairs Department, in a multitude of posts, diplomats are churning out interpretations of the society in which they're operating and making certain that our political leadership has the best possible information on the world around them. And I must say, I found a little bit to my surprise that almost every member of the Foreign Affairs Department whose cables I read were the best of writers. Foreign affairs officials are trained to write succinctly and relevantly, and they do. They are very good writers. Most of them are also very principled people and very patriotic people, and they are doing their best in often the worst of circumstances to make certain that Australia is influencing anyone in the nations in which they operate in a way that advances Australia's interests. And where you've got yourself into, your country's in a degree of trouble, doing their very best to extricate ourselves from it. You can't get a better read on that than when you look at what Sue has written. She has a talent for friendship. She made many friendships in the countries in which she represented us. But underlying that friendship, and it's not a sinister thing, there is a constant working of her relationships to, even if they're with people who've got almost no influence at all, to interpret the societies in which she is operating so that we can get an understanding of what those societies are like, and many of those societies are replicated in other countries close to the regions in which she is serving. While she was doing that, she did it so well that she was, in the many firsts in her life, she was the first female Australian ambassador to serve in an Islamic nation. Now, that's an enormous challenge. It's a challenge that she met more than adequately. So I think this is a book on tradecraft. It's a book on foreign affairs tradecraft and how you utilise your position patriotically to defend the interests of your country and to make certain that insofar as you act, you can say to yourself with assurance, you left no stone unturned in defending the national interest. I do know from Cabinet colleagues that Sue was held in the highest regard in the political scheme of things. Gareth Evans, who's arguably one of our greatest foreign ministers, thought the world of her, thought the world of her knowledge, her understanding. Gough Whitlam thought the world of her in a different context at the very beginning of her career. So this is a book which pure interest ought to dictate you read it. But as I look at some of the younger faces around here and think about the rationales as to why you've joined the Australian Institute of International Affairs, you're going to need this book for other purposes. You're going to need that so that you get to know how to be a very good foreign affairs officer. You're not the same sort of personality as Sue. Sue's unique. In her joyous attributes, and she doesn't boast about that. You just know it from reading through the book, which, as I said at the beginning, is a pure delight. So as I said also at the beginning, it's an absolute privilege on my part to be able to declare the book launched, and I do so now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Governor, and the gift of friendship and humour, not frivolous, and all the rest of it. It's a fantastic launch, and I'm sure Sue will have a lot to say about it. Now, as I just search through my notes, there was a Dick Van Dyke show once where someone got up and said all the things beforehand, but I did have a few more pages here. they're not under there. Okay.
There you go.
Thanks very much, Kim. And, well, thanks very much. And I can give you yours back in a minute. But thanks again, Governor. That was terrific. On Sue's behalf, obviously, Sue will thank on everyone's behalf. I'd like to introduce Kate Pickard now, who's the publishing manager at UWA Press, and she'll say a few words. So if you'd like to come up here, I'll vacate the mic. Thanks very much.
Thank you, John. Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much to the Governor. It was a fantastic launch speech. I'm Kate Pickard, the publishing manager at UWA Publishing, and it's my pleasure to be publishing Sue's memoir, Not Always Diplomatic. UWA Publishing is the publishing arm of the university and produces many different genres of books, from fiction all the way through to scholarly. My role is that of shepherd. I tend and nurture the manuscripts and turn them into wonderful books, like the fantastic book that we are here to celebrate tonight. I would like to thank the UWA publishing team for all their hard work. We're very small, but we managed to get a lot done. Sue has had a long-standing relationship with the University of Western Australia from her student days, as Kim eloquently discussed earlier, all the way through to her time as a member of the Senate. Sue's extraordinary life makes for a fascinating read. Enjoy, please buy copies. And Sue will be available to sign them later. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Kate. That's very kind of you from UWA Publishing. And it would be remiss of me just also to note, I observe in the audience tonight that we have the US Consul General to Western Australia and also the Honorary Consul for the Federal Republic of Germany who's here tonight. So welcome to you both. With that, I'd like to invite Sue to the stage, and Sue will talk about her book. And as I said, there'll be room for Q&A. And I suppose we'll get the mic happening as well. But I might just reflect on one thought. My wife happens to be here tonight, Jenny Matthews, who was joined the Department of Foreign Affairs some decades ago and made the comment that she looked around and there weren't many women in senior positions, and Sue was one of them, and all the rest of them were secretaries in the old sense of the word secretaries. So it's not that long ago, and that's something that Sue will be talking about tonight. And as probably just to embroider something that Kim said, the gift of friendship on a personal level, I've just found Sue's mentorship over the last two decades absolutely fantastic, and I've really enjoyed her with the ups and downs of writing and publishing a book. So with that, over to you, Sue.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks, John. Well, it's just terrific to look around the room and see so many of my friends. It's just lovely. Half the audience are from the Institute of International Affairs, and we are, of course, in a meeting tonight of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, West Australian branch, of which this is the president. So thank you very much for allowing me to barge into the meeting. Kim, thank you so much for first of all, taking the time to read my book. in the first place. And he did. He read it on a weekend. And while he was reading it, every time he found something in it that he thought I ought to pay attention to, he'd send me off a quick email. A quick message would come in, buzz, you know. They're not frigates, they're patrol boats. Yeah, all right, thank you. And the bicentenary was in 1988. Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, all it was just terrific. You know, the time you gave to it, Kim, and the care you gave to it was fantastic. And I was amazed when I saw what you'd written as the introduction. As everybody else will be, it's the first three pages of the book. Kim is known for being long-winded, as many of us know. You know, people say to me, "How long have you given him to talk this night?" He can talk as long as he likes. He's the governor, you know. But these three pages, there's not a word in it that's superfluous. They're wise. He gave me an insight into my own life, which I hadn't actually seen myself, I have to say. as he sort of traced my early history, I mean, I was born in India. As I say in one chapter, I was conceived in Quetta and born in Calcutta. And my parents, my mother's family, I was the fourth generation of my mother's side of the family to be born in India. And my father was in the British Army, and he was posted in there during the war. And he was a gunner, and he was posted to defend the airports of Dum Dum in Calcutta and Chittagong against potential attacks by the Japanese with anti-aircraft weapons. That was his role. That's what he did. And he met and fell in love with my mum. She didn't actually take to him too well in the first place, she tells me. Yeah, she said he thought his name was Bull Boyd. And she said, "Bull? You know, how can I go out with a bloke called Bull? You know, that can't be right." But of course, when we got to Australia, nobody believed his name was Bull. Everybody thinks it's Bill. So a lot of Daddy's friends still call him Bill, because that's what they hear in their ears. But anyway, we were in India, so it was a colonial sort of situation, the large British situation we were born into. And then, of course, my father being in the army, then we were taken out of India and sent to other places. So we went to Ireland, we went to England. My father was posted to Germany immediately after the war, and there were no quarters for families at that stage. It was part of the occupation forces in the British zone, and there was nowhere for families to live. So my mother and I were parked with my grandmother in Ireland for a year. I don't know that my mother thought about being separated from her husband for a year, but it was extremely good for us, because my mother, having been brought up in India with servants, hot and cold running servants, you know, my mother never cooked a thing in her life. You know, she never cleaned a room. When I was born, I had a nanny. She never cleaned a dirty baby's bottom. You know, she had no idea how to put on a nappy. My mother knew none of those things. So it's just as well we had that year with my grandmother in Ireland, because my grandmother knew all those things, and so she taught Mum. So at the end of that year, when we were able to go and join my father in Germany, Mum could do all those things. So my grandmother turned her into a perfect mother and housewife and hostess, and my mother was one of the best mothers you really could have had. She was home when we came home from school. She cooked nice cakes and biscuits. She made sure we were well-dressed. She went into battle for us against my father, because my father was taking the view, children don't need clothes, don't be stupid, they don't need clothes. I mean, one pair of shoes will do them, you know, all they have is one pair of shoes, they don't need to buy any more shoes. And Mummy would say, "Look, I'm sorry, Bull, but, you know, the girls actually need clothes, different clothes to wear. Boys might manage with one thing, but girls are different, you know, because there were two girls in the family." And she defended us and worked for us against my father. And sometimes, you know, my father would be just outrageously bullying. He bullied my brother appallingly. And my mother would say, "Darling, don't treat your children like your soldiers." You know? So, you know, it was that was the sort of family we grew up in. But grew up in Germany with, lots of staff in the house, because immediately after the war, the Allies really wanted to rebuild the economy of Germany. And the idea was to try and provide as much employment as possible and to grow the economy. So we had about eight people working in our house, all of whom were being paid. So it was all money into the German economy. I mean, I had a nanny. my brother and sister, who are twins. The twins had a nanny. We had a cook. We had a boiler man. We had a gardener. We had a housekeeper. Yeah, they were all, and of course, they were all German. And my mother was out and about, you know, army wives had things to do. She looked after refugees and she worked as a volunteer here and they did all sorts of things. But she wasn't home much, frankly, in that time. She was home at the right times. But so we basically had the German people in our house. So I grew up bilingual in German because I was talking to all those people as I was growing up. So I spoke English to my parents, and I spoke German to everybody else. And that was a terrific start. In fact, my mother says I was a terrific little interpreter because when I was three, some people came to the door and they were speaking German, and my mother didn't speak any German. So my mother called me up, and so I asked them, ja bitte, and they told me what they wanted. And I said, oh, mummy, it's the painters. They want to know, can they paint the dining room today? Yes, that'll be all right. Do come in. Yeah. And what colour do you want it painted, Mummy? Oh, yeah. So I was at age three. I was doing these sort of things. So it was a really, you know, a good international start to my life, really. So thank you, Kim, for tracing that. I never saw it as the end of the colonial era, but it was. In fact, we were there because we also went to Egypt and to Cyprus, where we were working, my father was working, fighting against indigenous or native local political forces who wanted autonomy for the country, and they were British colonies at the time. So we were involved in all of that. And after then we went through all that, then eventually came out to Australia. So it was very perspicacious, Kim, to see what you saw in my writing. There's a stuff that I hadn't seen for myself. So thank you, first of all, very much for doing that writing. And thank you very much for coming and launch it tonight. Thank you. Now, I also, of course, have to thank John and the Institute for supporting me all these years and being very good friends and really very supportive and very helpful and really make an important part of this book. Because since I came back to Australia after retiring from the Foreign Ministry in 2003, I've been quite busy in working in the various universities in Western Australia, working with staff who teach international relations and working with students who study international relations, and in St. Catharines College, students there being a mentor to them. And from all of them, the questions I was getting were, what's it like in the Foreign Service? What's it really like in the Foreign Service? What does the Department of Foreign Affairs do? You know, what's it actually like in an embassy overseas? Third secretary? What's a third secretary? What's the role of a third secretary? First secretary? What's the role of a first secretary? You know, and as a single woman, were you able to have a sex life? Yeah. That's my next book, because Terry Ann made me take it all out of this book. She said it wasn't appropriate. So anyway, yeah, but you know, all those sort of questions that people ask. And so really, this book I've written really in an attempt to answer all those questions that came to me from students over these last years. So I thank those students very much for their interest in the topic, for their long-running commitment to the study of international relations, and for really giving me the push, the incentive to write this book. So I'm very grateful to all those people. I'm particularly grateful to Crystal. Crystal, where are you? Where's Crystal sitting? Oh, there, Crystal. Because I've been talking for a long time about writing this book. And Crystal came up to me one day and said, Sue, you've been talking for a long time about writing this book, and it's about time you wrote it. And I will help you. I said, oh, really? How are you going to do that? She said, I'll be your research officer. And I said, oh, really? What does a research officer do? So she told me what a research officer would do, and I thought, well, that sounded pretty good, you know? And she said, I can't pay you for letting me do this. And I said, well thank you very much. It's an honor that you're wanting to do it. And I said, I can't pay you either. So we agreed that was all right. But then I thought, well, if she's going to be my research officer, I've got to give her some texts that she can read to give me feedback on. So I better sit down and start writing it. So that was really the trigger. So thank you very much for actually getting me going. There was a second trigger to my getting going at that time, who isn't here tonight, and that's my Vietnamese teacher who lives in Sydney. Because my book, as if you read it, you will see that there's quite a lot about my love of art and the world of art in it. And at my home, I have all my artworks all over all the walls of the place, and I knew that I had to write the book sitting with my artworks around me. So the problem was finding a way to have a table which I could put the computer on and a chair that I could sit in that room. How would that actually all work? You know, and so I looked around for some time to try and find it. And then my Vietnamese teacher said, Sue, come and see what I've got. And in his house in Sydney, he said, see this chair? I wrote my PhD in this chair. And this is a wonderful stressless chair, which is one that tilts back and holds you firmly and has a little table that comes out over your lap, which you can put your computer on. And it has a footstool. So when you get a bit tired, you can just a little kip there. But fantastic. So having got the table there and the way to write it and then the incentive, there was nothing to hold me back. And so I went at it. It took me 18 months to write this book. I was quite disciplined. I made sure that I was sitting at my computer at 10 o'clock every morning, having showered, having made up, having put my jewelry on, and being dressed for work. I was quite disciplined. I made sure I had all my appointments in the afternoon so that I could just do that in the morning, and that took me 18 months. So that's what we got. It took me another 18 months to find a publisher, I have to tell you. And thank goodness that Terry Ann saw the document. She'd given me quite a lot of guidance along the way and helped me shape it and given me some ideas and stuff. So eventually I said, well, I've reworked this now. Do you want to have a look at this? And so she had a look and said, yep, I think it's terrific. I'll take it. We'll print it. So thank goodness I found a publisher. So it was lovely. Thank you. Thank you very much. And also thank you very much, Kate, for guiding me through. Kate, have I got it? Yes. She really was the shepherd, shepherdess maybe one should say. You know, she helped me through. She rewrote things a bit. She wrote the blurb that you're all reading. I mean, that she wrote. I didn't write that. It's not sort of self-praise. She wrote that. So, but the press was fantastic in producing it. Other people who helped me along the way, who are here tonight, I'd like particularly to mention Maureen Smith, who's sitting in the front row here, and her partner Kevin. Maureen used to be head of University Extension, and she's a woman who knows books, and she's highly literate, and she took hold of my draft when it was in its first extremely rough stage, and ploughed her way through the draft and made lots of very useful suggestions about how we could make it better and how we could have it appealing to a wider audience and how to correct my grammar and all the things that she's very good at doing it. And then I met her partner, Kevin, who's sitting here. And so Kevin said, well, what's this book about? So I told him, and he said, what are you going to call it? I said, well, I'm not sure yet. He said, all right, well, I'll think about that. Anyway, that evening, as he was peeling the potatoes for dinner, he said, I've got the answer. Not always diplomatic. That's what she should call it. So here's the source. Unfortunately, my friend Bill Keane, who's here, Bill had the same idea pretty well at the same time. So they're both claiming authorship of the title. So I allocate both of you a share of the glory in this. Thank you very much. So there we go. That's the lot of the thanks. Oh, yes. Frances Adamson in DFAT in Canberra, who, as you say, is a fantastic woman. I've seen her through her career as she's gone on from strength to strength. Sterling woman, and well deserves to be head of DFAT. She's offered to do another launch in Canberra in DFAT. When we can get there, that is, So as soon as we can get there, so we will then, I'll be able to expose it to DFAT and my various friends who live in Canberra and so on can be asked to come along. So there we are. So the book does go along and really details things that happened in my various postings, and you'll read them, so I'm not going to tell you all about it now. But I will maybe read you a bit of the book so that you know what you're getting into. One of the posts which I was in was really, really very interesting was East Berlin. It was in the German Democratic Republic at that time. It was the height of the Cold War. It was a fantastic posting, a really very interesting posting. But of course, what I had to contend with there is what we all know now about Stasi, the state's secret intelligence service, because you know they were terrified as an intelligence service, terrified about foreign agents who might be undermining the GDR and trying to undermine the security of the country and to lead its citizens to betray the country. So if foreigners were very carefully kept under close observation, and they thought they needed to keep an eye on me, as I discovered, because I discovered after I left that there was a file on me, and all the observations, all the agents who'd been reporting on me, all the people I was talking to who'd been reporting what we'd been talking about, all the things they were finding out about me, were very Germanically and methodically catalogued in this 900 pages of file which I have. And I discovered that we got to know that the files were available after the GDR collapsed and after the reunification of Germany. And you could apply to your file. You put in an application at the nearest German embassy, and they came back to you, and it would cost you $5 or something to put that in. And then after a while, they came back and said, yes, we found files on you, and yes, we're happy to release them to you. But you're in Australia and we're in East Germany, or Germany as it was then. So if you'd like us to photocopy them and send them to you, we're happy to do that. So I thought that was just terrific and very generous. And it cost me $100, so I thought it was maybe cheap at half the price. So they photocopied them and sent them all out here. And I had enormous fun going through this file, I have to tell you. It's amazing, you know, what you could find out in this file. They built up a sort of picture of you, and they every time they found out something about it, they sort of added to the portrait that they had in there. They said that I was highly intelligent, and I was smart, and I was well groomed, and I was ambitious politically. I was interested in food and wine, but I didn't drink too much. This holding back on the drink wasn't because I, you know, was a difficult person. No, because by the jokes I told, they could tell that, you know, I was sort of looser than that. You know, so that's all there. But also, I discovered that whenever I went, as the file tells me. Whenever I went out of town, turns out, of course, that I was being followed. And so let me read you a bit of this book about being followed. This all comes from my file, which is also all in German, and so the translations are my own. They may or may not be totally accurate, but this is what we've got. So in the file, there were amusing detailed reports from Stasi operatives who were shadowing me on visits to towns outside Berlin. I visited Magdeburg, and the following report is in my file. She arrived at the edge of town at 8:30 a.m. and drove to the main hotel, arriving there at 8:38. She drove down a one-way street the wrong way twice, which made it hard to shadow her and showed her unfamiliarity with the town. She parked the car in front of the hotel, took out a brown suitcase, and checked in. She received the key to room 335. She went up to her room, came down again 5 minutes later. She walked around the town square, looking at the buildings and the shop windows, not seeming to be looking for anything in particular. She bought a postcard and sat down on the town hall steps to write it, then posted it in the postbox in front of the town hall. Here is the postcard. The postcard was addressed to my parents and read, "Here on a day and a half visit to talk about Australia. The town used to be the Krupp headquarters before the war and was therefore bombed almost out of existence. The cathedral and one or two other buildings are almost all of note which remains. The rest is quite modern. Love, Sue. Pretty subversive, that, I think. And my shadow's report continued. She went into a telephone box and looked up a telephone number in the phone directory. I could not see the name, but she found the number on page 183. And the last digits she dialed were 3 and 4. Later examination showed that this number belonged to Schmidt, but there had been no answer. Amazing that he was close enough to see that detail, and I had no idea, as we chatted. Then he goes on. She went for a drive outside the town and stopped frequently to consult a map. I was forced to overtake her during these stops in order not to look as if she was being followed, and lost her on a couple of occasions, but eventually picked her up in the next village. So then I gave the talk, which is what I'd gone there for. He tried to record that with total disaster because the recorder malfunctioned, the battery ran out, the recharger malfunctioned. He was in the room next to where I was speaking, so he didn't know who was speaking. He didn't speak any English, so it wasn't actually a great record. But anyway, there are a number of such reports made by someone tailing me on the few visits I made to towns around the GDR, all equally painstakingly observed and clearly revealing nothing of any consequence. I have to confess to having been unaware at the time that I was being tailed. They did it very well. Even on one occasion, tailing me and my companions on a narrow path into a forest, where we stopped in a clearing, put down a rug, and had a picnic. The report detailed what we ate and drank, including the label of the wine. quite extraordinary. So there was lots of things about my time in the GDR, which is fascinating reading, which is all in the book. When you read it, you can get all the details. Another thing I'd like to read you was when I was posted in the United Nations in New York. The Australian delegation to the UN is made up of a number of people, more or less all at the first secretary level. Each of us are responsible for particular areas of policy. I was responsible for disarmament, outer space, the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, the zone of peace in the Indian Ocean. I think that's about all I think I was responsible for. The key thing we looked at the UN, our resolution every year, our key resolution, one was on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Australia was totally, in our move to do something about the spread of nuclear weapons, the containment of nuclear weapons, our main area of focus was the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. And, of course, our allies, close allies, were the Americans, and they, of course, are nuclear weapons states. So they weren't at all happy at Australia doing anything that could undermine them because they thought that would undermine the alliance. So anyway, I and my colleagues thought that really the times had changed. People were very worried about nuclear situation in Australia. Parents were deciding not to have children because they were worried about the nuclear world. People were building nuclear shelters in their gardens. It was a very worrying time, and the government really needed to do something about nuclear policy. And so we thought at the UN that we could do something about that, and we could craft a different sort of resolution which we could take account of those concerns in the Australian public, but yet move things along. And we thought we could have it in such a way that we get away with sort of pushing it past the Americans. So I drafted something to this and sent it back to Canberra. And in the meantime, there was a change of government, and Bill Hayden became a foreign minister. So he was now the fellow looking at what I was doing. So I like you, this is now reading from the book. Picture a table on the pavement outside a hamburger joint in New York near the United Nations in October 1983. Australian Foreign Minister Bill Hayden, Australian United Nations Ambassador Dick Walcott, the Minister from the Australian Embassy in Washington, D.C., Tim MacDonald, and United Nations First Committee Australian Delegate, me, are all sitting around a small table of the hamburger joint on the pavement on 3rd Avenue, close to the Australian delegation office and the United Nations headquarter building. The subject of discussions was Australia's key disarmament resolution at the United Nations on a comprehensive nuclear test ban treaty. So I've skipped out a fair bit here, which you can read when you get the book, but it says, Australia and New Zealand were leading the international demands for comprehensive nuclear test ban treaty, an important step to control a nuclear arms race. Without nuclear testing, it was unlikely that states could progress to build and stockpile nuclear weapons or test the continuing potency of weapons they might already possess. Australia and New Zealand each year jointly introduced a resolution to the United Nations General Assembly via the First Committee, looking to persuade more UN member states to agree to negotiate such a treaty, and so on. So the Australian delegation to the United Nations, serving the new Labour government, thought that the time was ripe for change. It was in Australia's interest to be more assertive in the United Nations on arms control questions. So we then set out all our positions. So now, when Foreign Minister Bill Hayden arrived in New York in late 1983 for the United Nations General Assembly, he had all the papers with him. He was interested in our proposal and asked Ambassador Dick Walcott to invite Tim McDonald, a senior member of our embassy in Washington, to join us in New York for full discussion. So we four found ourselves eating hamburgers on a pavement at lunchtime, considering a change to Australia's position on nuclear testing and ways to strengthen the way Australia's policy was presented. So I set out my arguments, and the contrary case was raised by Tim McDonald, who held the senior diplomatic rank of minister at our embassy in Washington. Apart from arguing against the merits of the case, because he was absolutely all the way with LBJ, he denigrated my relatively junior standing, my youth, and my gender. Hayden was having none of this and told him firmly to play the ball and not the woman. He had listened to the arguments and decided that the New York delegation's proposal was sound, and that was how that year's resolution and vote would be crafted. So it was a change in Australian policy and the change we went about it, and it's interesting to sort of see in detail and sometimes how it's done. You know, it's not all being done in lofty corridors in Canberra. Some of it's being done in the field. So I tell this story as an insight into the way policy shifts sometimes come about. It gave me great satisfaction as the Australian delegate to explain our change position to the whole membership of the United Nations in the General Assembly that year. A New York taxi driver once asked me, "So what do you do at the United Nations, lady? You a secretary or something?" I replied coolly, "Actually, I negotiate arms control agreements." So that was thinking. Now, when I first came back to Canberra, after my first post was in Portugal, Timor, of course, was the question that really occupied us. Gough Whitlam called me into his office. He wanted to be briefed. I'd been back one day after the revolution in Portugal. And he boomed out at me. He said, "So, Susan," he said, "what's going on in Portugal? What does it mean for Australia? And what should we do about it?" So that was pretty good. I mean, that's actually what all embassies need to keep in mind as they go about their work. So that's what I was engaged in doing with Timor. The civil war unfolded, lots of action. And the department decided to set up a small office in Darwin, partly to look after the refugees who were coming out of Timor, but also because the Portuguese had sent a peace mission in to try and negotiate a solution to what was happening in East Timor. And they sent me up there to head this office. It was a small office, one foreign affairs officer, me, in a small office on the Air Force base next to the Air Force commander, who was a racist, sexist shit. What did the department think they're doing? You know, those wankers down in Canberra, you know, sending up a girl to do a man's job. What do you think they think they're doing? I mean, this is the sort of stuff I put up with every day. But anyway, just got on with it. So the work was relentless, but during a rare lull one afternoon, I told the Australian Air Force commander that I was going to take a break at the hotel swimming pool and invited him to join me there for a beer. Leering down the front of my dress, he said that if he came, he wouldn't be getting the outside of his bathers wet. Charming, charming. So that was, you know, that was what you put up with. But that night, while I was asleep in my hotel bed, a telephone call came from Canberra, soon after midnight. Australia had intelligence that the Indonesians were planning to invade East Timor. I was instructed to pass this on to the Portuguese peace mission. Following Cyclone Tracy, my hotel was the only one in town with a night telephone service. So I sent a Commonwealth car to the hotel where the peace mission was staying with a message to the Consul General to contact me. The peace mission at that stage was headed by the Portuguese Consul General in Sydney, a man called José Eduardo Melo Gouveia. So I sent a message for Commonwealth car to ask them to contact me. So next thing, there was a phone call from the reception at my hotel. This is, you know, now about 1 o'clock in the morning. The Consul General was downstairs. Would he come up? No, he would prefer it if I came down. I had dressed by this stage and went down to find Melo Gouveia in the Commonwealth car in his pyjamas in front of the hotel. I gave him the news, you know, of what we'd picked up from intelligence, and he asked if he could use the phone in my room to call Lisbon and the Portuguese embassy in Jakarta, because, of course, his phone in his hotel couldn't call out. So his pyjamas were of that blue striped cotton, you know, with the pants held together by a tied cord. He hurried across the hotel foyer in his bare feet, holding the cord. In my room, he sat on my unmade bed, because the telephone was on the bedside table, and made his calls. Just because you're my friends and you won't tell anybody else, I'm going to tell you a little bit of extra secret, which actually is not written in this book. When he was sitting on my bed, his legs were astride, the cord had parted, and the crown jewels were on full display. I thought it would be a bit embarrassing for him if he read this in the book, so I haven't put it in the book, but you know, just between us, don't tell anybody else, we know, you know. Anyway, he made his calls. I suggested he put it together, and he did, yeah. Anyway, so afterwards, the rest of the Portuguese peace mission arrived, the naval and army officers in full uniform, and stood formally in my hotel bedroom. It was rather a bizarre scene. So that's in the book. You can read all about that too. And there's one more bit I want to read to you. Again, back to the United Nations. When I was there, as you know, I was looking after disarmament stuff. Where is this? Page 128. Looking after disarmament, and we had a special conference on disarmament, which had been called by the United Nations, the United Nations Second Special Session on Disarmament. A preparatory committee made up of delegates from interested member states was established to pave the way for the full special session, and met a number of times in New York in the run-up to the special session. I was the Australian delegate in the preparatory committee. At the end of each day's session, the Indian chair, Ambassador A.P. Venkateshwaran, known familiarly to all of us as Venkat, would say, "Well, gentlemen, I think that concludes our business for today. I declare the meeting closed." After a couple of days of this, at the end of the meeting, I interrupted the chair and asked for the floor. I said, "Mr. Chair, the women delegates at these meetings are getting extremely tired. Each day you close off work only for the gentlemen. So we women have been in continuous session. Could I ask that you close off the work for the whole committee?" Ambassador Venkat replied, "I apologize to the most beautiful, most charming lady delegate of Australia, but when I was at school, we were taught that man embraces woman unless otherwise specified." Quick as a flash, and for this I'm quite proud, I replied, "Sir, I am sure that your school also taught that gentlemen do not embrace ladies unless specifically invited." We had a good laugh and no further sexist language. So there we are. So the book's full of some serious stuff and some lighthearted stuff, and really, you've all bought it already, and those of you who haven't, there's a few copies left. And you can buy some for your friends and relatives and make a very good Christmas present at Christmas time. Because I also have to thank very much my friends from the Lane Bookshop. who are looking after all the books tonight. They've bought the books and have brought them in for you to sign. And they're, I have to say, very generously giving us a proportion of the profits from the sale of the books tonight to help offset the cost of the grog that you've consumed on the way in. So buy lots of books and support the Lane Bookshop. Thank you all very much for the Lane Bookshop.
I've got to say, I'm also pleased with volume two coming, the unexpected version. Well, look, Sue's very kindly agreed to take some questions and answers, and we've got two roving mics. And as a courtesy, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourselves, so Sue knows who you are, and we all know who you are. And so can I see a question right in the middle?
Patrick Cornish.
Oh, hello, Patrick. Hello, Patrick.
So it seems to me that now we have the greatest ever need for constructive diplomacy, and yet we're surrounded and buffeted by the most undiplomatic divided nonsense. How is someone like you viewing this state of affairs?
Obviously with not a lot of happiness, Patrick. You know, it's not a situation which is in anybody's interest. The question is really how you manage it. And as I'm not on the inside anymore, I don't quite have access to all the information which people in government have. But I know it's a huge challenge. But what you do when you have on the one hand your major trading partner and someone to whom you have been quite close and you've worked very closely with over the years to build a good relationship, find a changing situation and change behaviour, then how does Australia respond to that? How do we balance all our interests? I don't know the answer to that. And I must say, if anybody asked me to write something about it, I think I would rather not at the moment. But I know that we've got fantastic diplomats on the ground who are doing all the hard work and reading the situation and making the contacts and working hard to try and ease things. We've got members of Parliament who have been less than helpful, but they've got their own row to hoe. And you've got all sorts of members in the community and interest groups in the community who've also got a say in it all. And then we've just got at least two ABC journalists who've been really forced out just now. So there's a lot going on which is not good. And we can only hope that things will get better. I have to just say quietly, you know, we're just amongst friends here, that Trump isn't helping any, you know. You can see what he's trying to do. You can see what his domestic political concerns are. But to talk about COVID as the Chinese sickness, which has been sent over specifically to undermine our societies, is really not helpful. So it's an unhelpful situation. And if you've got the answers, I'm sure people would be glad to hear them.
Thank you. Thanks, Patrick. I think I saw...
Jay, I think, was it?
Turned out to be a huge district, and a printing error to be repeated six times later.
Oh my goodness me! Oh my goodness, what the date wrong? Have we, Jay?
Brought your dates to the more exciting 88.
It was 98 to 99. Oh dear! Oh bugger! Oh bugger! All the proofreading we did, and we didn't pick that up. Oh, well, we have to correct that.
Anyway, but still, I'd like to ask you, because
We've only printed 750 copies. I'm sure I could go through and change it by hand in the mall, yeah. Very boring.
But that, in a way, you know, is actually praise for the fact that the one country, two system was probably working well. Seriously. After the CCP's takeover of the four British colonies. And so from that point of view, I mean, your point is the first consul general from Australia in the, you know, post and over era. So what do you have to say?
Well, thank you for picking up that error. That's a serious error, and I'm really, really sorry. And that's gone through all sorts of proofreading, so it just shows, you know, how hopeless proofreading is. I'm really sorry about that, but you're quite right. Yes, it was for me. That was boring for me in that sense that I'd just come from Vietnam, where I had a very intense political and active role to help things in Vietnam. I had 3 years there. Being closely involved with business and with the different aspects of government and doing all sorts of things. Then I went to Hong Kong, and as you said, it was just after handover, and things were actually just going quite smoothly. The handover had happened. People were going apart by their lives. Normally, if I look at the staff of the Australian Consul General, Consulate General, everybody there had a job to do except me. You know, the trade commissioner was happy helping businesses do their trading, and there was no political side to that, so there's nothing I could help with. You know, the immigration people were dealing with immigrants in a straightforward sort of way. There was nothing for me to get involved with there, you know. The spies were happily spying, and there was nothing for me to get involved with there. They were just getting on with their stuff, you know. And the consular people were busy looking after people who had consular. Everybody in the mission had a clear role except me at that stage, having come from a place where I had a lot of stuff. I did, of course, monitor what was happening, and there was a court case going on at the time which was testing the validity of the handover, and Sir Anthony Mason was on that court, and he was good enough to keep me informed on how the proceedings were going on in that court, and I followed that very closely. But as you say, things were actually pretty well okay, which is why there wasn't much to occupy me. The fact that it was okay was something worth noting. And also preparation for Macau's handover, because the Chinese had told the Portuguese that they were in no hurry to take back Macau. They want to just leave Macau for the moment, thank you. We'll just see where we go and get Hong Kong out of the way, and then we'll think about Macau. And so Hong Kong now being out of the way, they were now moved towards Macau too. And I was accredited to Macau, and because I spoke Portuguese, I was very happy I could go and chat to the Consul General in Macau, and I could talk to the media and stuff, and they were all amazed here was this Australian who could speak Portuguese. Yeah? So I was having quite a good time, but I couldn't see that I was doing much, really, to serve my government's interests. Anything that really concerned my government's interests was now being done in Beijing. It wasn't being done in Hong Kong. If it was now, of course, the situation wouldn't be entirely different. There's plenty of things that concern Australia, from basic security to thousands of people wanting to emigrate, you know, a huge amount of work. If I was there now, it would be a different report, but that was then.
Thanks. Now, Cameron Dye, top left up there.
Hello, Diane, you made it.
Diane Smith came.
Oh, well, Cameron, excellent, yeah, welcome.
There, just here.
Actually was just waving to say hello, John.
Hi.
But Sue, I haven't heard all the questions that other people have asked, but I do wonder why there was so much about sex in your book.
Well, it's a big part of people's lives, really, you know. And you've pointed this out before. I gave Diane a print version, you know, by email, so that she could read it, because she very kindly wrote nice things about the book, which you'll read what her comment on it was. And she said to me, she said, you know, I can't believe this book. She said, if I put in the search engine the word sex, about 100 references come up in this book. And if I just go to each of those references and follow those, it's amazing stories I find out. So that was a finding that she brought to my attention. Readers, you have your different views on these things. But I'd have liked to have written more, really, about sex in my book. But there's two things, you know. I mean, I have to say, I mean, Peter Edwards is very nice. Peter, in his nice bit he writes about my book, says that I was single but not celibate, and that's right. So, I had quite a good time. And I've said to people, you know, I was very lucky in that my generation, we were the post-pill and pre-AIDS generation. So, you know, we had an enormous freedom when we were young, you know. Really, because if everything was possible and you could do all sorts of wonderful things. And then suddenly I was actually in New York when the awfulness of AIDS struck. Because up till that stage, every gay person in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade went to New York on holidays. You know, it was the gay capital of the world. And half the people in the staff are gay. And they'd come to the meetings on Monday morning, you know, full of what they'd been doing over the weekends, you know, in detail, gory detail. I learnt a huge amount of things that I didn't know before, you know, in all those meetings. But then, of course, AIDS came along, so people's behaviour changed. But nonetheless, there I was in different postings, and of course, I met really nice men, and I worked in an environment of intelligence. Intelligent people were there, including intelligent men. And I've often been asked, Sue, how come, you know, you were never married? And the answer is really, well, a couple of answers. One is, you know, all the really good men have already been snapped up by good women. And that's very good, and I'm very happy about that. It's just that those women have got to be prepared to share them with people like me. Yeah. And the beauty about having affairs with married men is you can give them back to their wives when you've had enough of them.
Well, you know, in similar veins, can I have a follow-up? Sorry. In similar vein, I have it on extremely good authority that when you were the president of the Guild at this august institution, that in your welcome speech to the freshers, you gave them a piece of very important advice. And I want to know whether this is true. Did you tell them not to lose their virginity in the back of a car as you had?
These are without notice.
The answer is no. It was Michael Chaney here tonight? Yes. Yeah, Michael's a bloody source of this story. Where are you, Michael? There you are. Yeah. Michael's the source of this story because it became an ongoing joke between us over the years. No, we had this week called Sex and the Single Student to educate students about sex. And it really came about because a fellow student in college died of a backstreet abortion. And when I was talking to my doctor in Hampton Road, she said, you know, I'm surprised at how ignorant university students are about sex. I mean, you're all highly intelligent people, but there's a huge amount of stuff you don't know about. And she told me about one couple, these weren't students, were an ordinary couple, who were having trouble conceiving. And so she went through the sort of initial mechanics of it all and said, well, you know, this is what you do and this is what you do. And then, you know, then you stick it there and, you know, ejaculate. And he said, you stick it there? I always thought I stuck it in my navel, in her navel. As he thought the thing was to stick it in her navel, and he was wondering why they weren't having any children. So that was the thing that the doctor told me. So we had this Sex and the Single Student Week. So it was just to educate students about all this sort of stuff. And what you're referring to was in that lecture, I said to the students, I said, you need to think about sex. You need to think about how you want to run your lives, what you want to do and what you don't want to do. You don't want to wait till you're in the back of the surfies wagon parked at the beach to decide, no, I don't want to do this after all. You know, you've got to make up your mind before you're in that situation. That's the story. It wasn't freshers, you know, it was old people. And then Michael picked this up later because Michael came to visit me in Vietnam when he was trying to flog gas or something for one of the companies working for. Anyway, he came to me, and the embassy at that stage was in a suburb called Van Phuc. Van Phuc. And he said, the suburb of the Shagger's wagon, eh? So that was it.
Nothing if not diplomatic. Now, Amy's got a question here, our former vice president. Amy.
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm busy at the moment marketing this book. I have this wonderful PR advisor who's here, given to me by the publishers, who's helping me line up reviews and articles and interviews and stuff. And so I'm doing that for the moment because we want to sell the book, you know. I don't think I'm ever going to get rich from this book. I don't think, you know, it's going to be thank God I've got my pension from DFAT is all I can say, really. I'm not actually relying on this book. But I have enjoyed the process. So what I'm doing next, I'm really continuing to do what I'm doing. You know, I'm on a couple of boards. I'm mentoring students. I'm doing a whole lot of things which I enjoy a lot. I'm trying to keep fit. During this lockdown, I've lost 5 kilos, which is pretty good. It's not going out, not eating, not drinking, you know, all those things. I want to go on doing anything that anybody thinks I could be useful in, let me know, basically.
Right. Now, Robin McClellan, a former US Consul General here.
Thanks so much. What a wonderful evening. And I hate to turn the conversation away from the great personal story, but talking about people being ignorant made me think about what would you like the broader public to understand about, well, I would say, of course, embassies and foreign affairs missions in general, but particularly the Australian foreign affairs apparatus that they pay for and is at their service that, in my opinion, is woefully misunderstood. Just as the governor said, if you join your job, it doesn't turn up in the newspaper. What can we tell people so that they can value this and support it? Because things we don't value and support don't get money.
You're right, and that is really a major challenge. When I, one stage in the department, I was running public affairs. And this television producer came to see us and said he wanted to put together a television program, a series, about life in an Australian embassy. So, you know, would we be prepared to help him? So, I, being head of public affairs, I said, yes, you know, I'd be happy to help them. I thought that was a good way to try and get the word out there about what happens in an embassy. And so he started to develop that script. And at that stage, John Dowth, was my predecessor in public affairs, was working with Gareth Evans. And I started to tell John about this project. And John just shouted me down. He poo-pooed it. He wasn't going to listen to halfway through. And I thought, well, fuck him. I won't tell him about the story. I'll just get on to it. I'm in the job now. I'm going to authorise it. We're going to do it, you know. So we did it. Well, of course, it turned out to be a bit of a disaster because they set the embassy in Malaysia. And I don't know if you remember, but Mahathir took great offence at it. He thought it portrayed them, and it was all a bit awkward, really. The programmes had been made, and I'd been helping them. Luckily, they said, would I like to have my name on the credits? And luckily, I'd said no, you know. But this went on. So anyway, so terrible. So the questions in Parliament, and Gareth stood up and said, I can assure everybody that my department has had no hand in this. This is an entirely private sector enterprise, and I'm not answerable to it. So, and then he sat down. But anyway, I went back to my office, and I thought, shit, what am I going to do, you know? We have, in fact, had quite a lot to do with this. Just he doesn't know about it. So I sort of confessed, he was furious. In fact, he got somebody else to call me and say, Gareth wants me to speak to you rather than speaking to you himself because he is so angry he can't trust himself to talk to you directly. Oh, he said, I have misled Parliament, which is a heinous crime for a Member of Parliament. And you've caused me to mislead Parliament. Well, hadn't actually directly caused it, but that's what happened. So I was very, I had to apologise, and he had to stand up in Parliament and say that unfortunately he'd been misinformed, and you know. So the crisis passed, of course. Crises do pass. They're just dreadful at the time. I mean, I nearly wet myself about four times in the morning, you know, dealing with him on the phone because, you know, he can be quite fearful, really. But, there are various ways to try and do it, but, you know, trying to find the right way to do it is an issue. I think you have to have people talking about it. I think the more interviews you can do with diplomats coming back from their postings on radio shows, get radio hosts interested in asking them, well, what actually is your work involved, what are you doing, and what are the issues, what does it mean as a person, what's the personal cost to doing all this job on behalf of your country? I mean, all those things, I think maybe a series of interviews would be useful.
And a question in the middle, Jenny Matthews.
Well, I think women coming through the ranks now, it's a different time for them, really. They don't have to fight the battles that we had to fight. I mean, you know, a lot's been done in the public service. I mean, you know, when I was first a head of mission, there were only four women heads of mission. I was one of four. I mean, when I joined the department, we were 23 in our year, the class of 1970, 23, and two of us were women. You know, so the previous year they'd only had one woman, and they'd been so horrid to her that she'd left. The blokes had really sort of terrorised her. I think they decided that she wasn't the sort of person they wanted in the department. I think you have to be properly prepared. You have to be professional. You have to take the job seriously, but not too seriously. You know, the bit of humour goes down well. You've got to work with these blokes, so you might as well have them on your side rather than being your enemy. You know, all those sort of things.
And there's probably the last question there, lady just up there on the right.
Thank you, Sir, for bringing us all here and listening to you and talking about the story and your really amazing and inspiring. I wanted to ask a question regarding the international affairs and how we can Australia maintain the international affairs with other people on the diplomatic level, but it's on the side of the immigration. When you're applying for a visa, for example, I originally come from Zambia and I want my family to come over and visit me. And when I'm applying for a visa, for one of my family members to come over, they will say, not enough incentive and really say, do not appeal. And only because she is married with children and only because she doesn't have a property, she doesn't own a property in the country. But when you look at the reality and you being around the world, you find that there is so many people who would like to travel honestly and genuinely travel and come back without property. Is that a fair requirement to be put as part of a requirement to travel to Australia?
I have to say, luckily, I never worked for the Department of Immigration. But I had people in the office, you know, who did that work. And I know it's difficult. I mean, I know, for example, when I was in Bangladesh, you know, we gave visas to all the people who came to Australia with the... I was patron of the cricket club, and the cricket team came to Australia and played against Australia, and we gave visas to all the supporters who came with them. Most of those people disappeared into the community, where it became illegal immigrants, you know. So careful though we were in who we gave visas to, the people in the office who did those things, nonetheless, those sort of things happened. And it's a very difficult situation. I have to say, on the whole, immigration officers are shits, you know. I mean, this is just between friends, the secret here. But, you know, they're faced so much with so much fraud and so much lies and so much dissimulation. And, you know, amongst the really very good people who are applying. So they've got to, they sort of develop a sort of thick skin, and they have to really weed out. I mean, in Bangladesh at one stage, you know, everybody wanted to come to Australia. And as soon as there was something in the newspaper saying Australia was opening its borders a bit, we'd have about 3,000 people outside the gates of the High Commission in Dhaka. Yeah? So what to do about this? So we put notices up saying, it isn't true, you know, but those they got torn down and people sold them to other people. So then we printed about a million handbills to hand out amongst the crowd. And again, the guards on the gate were only handing them out when they were selling them. So they were corrupt. So you were dealing in a, you know, very, people were desperate, you can understand that. But I'm glad you're from Zambia because I worked in Zambia. When I was 18, I was a teacher at Masuku Mission in outside of Choma in the southern province, and I learnt a bit of Chitonga, and so you know I've really had a year there and I loved it. So I'm really delighted that you're here tonight. Thank you for coming. Thank you for your question. I'm sorry I can't give you any satisfaction.
Now, I said one more question, but one more question, Andrea. Last question, and we'll grab the microphone too, it does help.
Yeah. Thank you, John. Andrea Gleeson from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. It's actually not a question. I feel, I don't know if any of my colleagues from the department are here tonight, but I really feel, Sue, that I have to thank you. You're an immense inspiration to us all. You've been a mentor to me over the years, and we love you. And we really hope, I know my colleagues are really looking forward to having you coming over to Canberra and addressing us all there to tell us about your amazing experiences and share your wisdom. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea.
Well, on that note, fabulous Sue, the one and only Dr. Sue Boyd. I'll ask my colleague, Professor Mark Beeson, who's the fellow in charge of research for the Institute nationally, amongst other things, part of the National Executive for the Institute of International Affairs. Mark.
Thanks very much, John. What a great night, what a great evening, and what a great life. The book is absolutely fantastic. One of the things that Sue didn't mention about the book is that it comes replete with photos of Sue looking tremendously glam in lots of exotic foreign parts. And for some of us, Sue is still the most glamorous woman on the campus. I think there's probably a sexist and superficial remark, but that's the sort of thing that we used to say in the old days. So I don't think I don't think Sue will object too much. But my great privilege this evening is to thank not one, but two national treasures. I'm also going to offer a vote of thanks for Kim for his inspirational speech, one of many I've heard him make. And it's worth pointing out, this is a slightly political point, but of the current and former political leaders in this country, there aren't too many who recognize just how valuable universities, the social sciences in particular, are, and I think it's great that he's a product of that sort of process and recognizes the value of some of the things we do in these kinds of institutions. So that's a little party political point, but I thought I'd take the opportunity to do so. Now, I think secreted here somewhere, I am very much mistaken. Okay, so it's my great pleasure and honour to pass on a copy of the book to Kim for his wonderful oration, and I've got an opportunity to ingratiate myself with the new Vice Chancellor, who I've not had the opportunity to meet so far, but I'm going to present him with the book as well. So would you like to join me in thanking particularly Kim and Sue for their wonderful talks tonight?
Thank you, Kim. Thank you.